Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton. And today, I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and podcaster and writer Emil Niazi. The first time I made a reference to a 90s teen movie to a person a decade younger than me and they had never heard of it, it was a deeply jarring experience. Even though this was a 90s movie set in the 70s and I was not yet a teen when I saw it, Dazed Confused was integral to my youth and shaped what I thought being a teen looked like and behaved like. I highly doubt that Dazed Confused will ever be remade, nor should it be, but the same can't be said for a number of 90s teen movies that are seeing remakes being released right now, including a gender-swapped She's All That, of course titled He's All That. Now, this speaks to the fact that although certain social sensibilities do change, content warning in for today's movies for a whole bunch of LGBTQ plus slurs, the underlying experience of being a teen and what teens will pay money to watch in movies really hasn't changed. And with that having been said, Emil, how do you feel the teen movies of the 90s decade both reflected and shaped millennials?
I think that there was a real underlying sense of cruelty of the social hierarchy, which I certainly think contributed to our generational and cultural neuroses. I think that they were less vulnerable than today's teen movies are. I think that's also reflected in our generational breakdown. No, I think that the teen movies were great. They were kind of superficial in the best way. Like, they were real escapist. I think that they represented and could shape what was like cool culturally in a way that movies now can't, because we just have so much access to monoculture on the internet. But back then, like, you really kind of had to pick and choose your artifacts in order to belong to a subculture or have a kind of a shared language with other people in that subculture for how to, you know, talk about everything from music to fashion to, sex and romance. So I think that films for us back then were like a big part of that language and that transaction of belonging. And I think in that way, it is like, it makes a lot of sense to me why not just we revisit it, but, Gen Zs and people younger kind of seek out that material, because that kind of thing that shortcut doesn't really exist in the same way.
One of the years we're also covering this podcast season is 1985, which is the year of like both St. Elmo's Fire and Breakfast Club and like all of Rat these pack. Really defining moments of exactly of 80s teens. And watching those movies, there's a lot more aspect of camaraderie of like everybody needing to come together, whereas here it seems more like a versus situation. And obviously we're going to be comparing one of the films today to Heather's, which is about the battle between the class groups. And I think that's interesting that now in the 90s, you're seeing that battle between them rather than everybody coming together for camaraderie.
Yeah. So, I mean, 80s is very snobs versus slobs in a more broad way, where you like just, I guess it's like that the rich people aren't actually involved at all. They're like caricatures. Though, I don't know. It's weird because something like St. Elmo's Fire, they're all weird yuppies. So, I mean, that one's odd because it's like they're all in their 25s or something. It's a rare movie that is not teens being teens. It's weird.
I think class consciousness was a big part of the 80s, like Pretty in Pink. This idea that like you really did have to be, you know, part of the country club or have the right clothes to have access to the in-group. Whereas I think in the 90s, it was much more about this like It was the heyday, right? It was this great economic boom time, the Clinton era. A lot more people were part of the middle class. There was a lot less of that kind of haves versus have nots. So then the division, the social division, was about like subcultures, like geeks versus freaks and that kind of thing. And so I think that's also kind of more interesting in a way to me, but because it obviously is an important through line, that the class stuff, but it also makes for a less nuanced and exciting like thing when someone crosses over subcultures, or when someone sits at the other table. It's more interesting if it's not so definitively like rich and poor, you know. Gross to like aspire to the rich group in school, right? That's like really disgusting. Like, why would you want that?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's most of the 90s movies too, like Clueless and stuff is kind of about like the riches. There's always somebody there to deflate it. And I think that's also like a Gen X. These movies are as much Gen X as comments on John Hughes movies of like, yeah, it's that, but now it's edgy. Like, look out, you know?
All right, well, let's get into our first movie today. One of the lines that most dates our first movie is, email is for geeks and pedophiles. But the film itself does have a timeless message. Teenagers are extremely horny and will pay a large amount of money to watch a quarter of the current young Hollywood hotness sexually pursue each other. Now, even the text of the movie is based on has stood the test of time. Les Liaisons Dangereuses was written in 1782 and had already had multiple career-defining film versions of the basic story. But with the 90s successfully plumbing older but enduring texts for plot lines, think Clueless and Emma, She's All That and Pygmalion, 10 Things I Hate About You and Taming of the Shrew, etc., it just made sense to make this sexy story a teen movie and add a chin-wag-worthy kiss between Selma Blair and Sarah Michelle Gellar. Ooh, Buffy behaving badly. Let's get to the theater. Cruel Intentions. Does it hold up as much as the original story, or is it now just a cultural oddity artifact? Cam, what do you think?
I think it's good. I don't know. I don't know what to say. I think it's so weird and unique, and it might be of its time, but it's of its time in a way that's like precious almost. And I think it's also worth saying, like, Cruel Intentions, as much as you're like, yes, plumbing the classics, it's like he was ripping off a movie from 10 years before, really. Let's not pretend Dangerous Liaisons wasn't a big deal and that Ryan Phillippe isn't acting like John Malkovich and stuff. Cruel Intentions, I think it's fun. I think it's weird. It's a great movie. Obviously, the story is two step-siblings, Catherine and Sebastian, played by Sarah Michelle Gellar and Ryan Phillippe. They are, you know, disaffected, bored. They love playing sexual games with each other and everyone around them.
So twisted.
He is bored with how easy it is to bed everyone in Manhattan. She is trying to defend. He is a rake. Publicly, she manages to pretend to be a good girl while being crass and devious. Well, first she wants to destroy a woman. There's kind of two threads. She wants to destroy Cecile, played by Selma Blair, who stole her boyfriend. And then also Ryan Phillippe gets a little obsessed with a girl who wrote a article for 17 Magazine about how she's going to stay a virgin until she's married, played by Reese Witherspoon. And he decides, they make a bet that he can't or can or cannot take her virginity. So it's kind of these two threads weaving in and out of each other while they play devious games, and maybe Ryan Phillippe gets too close and actually learns love and grows a conscience. We shall see.
But does he? I think that's the one part that I genuinely didn't. There's many things that I was along the ride for with this, being like, okay, this is just weird and absurd, and you know, they're pushing all kinds of buttons. But the ending twist of like, is he actually in love with her? What is going on? Like, that's the one personality shift that I don't think I totally bought on for. But like, you want, like, every girl's dream, and the core of this is you want to turn the bad guy good, and he's like, he's a good guy at heart if I just stick with it. That's the point, right?
Yeah, that might also be the big shift. Like, I guess I as a man, I am interested to know, do you guys, is it, like, the thing that I think is probably the hardest to swallow these days is that, like, the whole movie starts with Ryan Phillippe doing, like, a weird, elaborate revenge porn thing on Tara Reid, and then I think you're supposed to kind of be charmed by him after that? Like, does that still hit right, or is that like a little too weird in 2022?
I think I just think that his whole character is like could not really exist in the same way right now. Mm. You know, obviously hallmarks of the 90s, abet, virginity, are all present.
Sure.
Compared to like a Chuck Bass, it's a very Chuck Bassian kind of character. And even that character, for example, in the Gossip Girl reboot, that like the quote unquote woke reboot of 2021. Or 2020, I don't even remember.
Who knows?
That character has had to evolve too, because they're like, ooh, our rakes have to be a little bit more in touch with their understanding of sexuality as a spectrum and sure. consent culture and all of those things. So I don't think I think that character would have to be so updated for like a modern version of this.
He definitely would be bisexual. I feel yes, like that's a thing that this movie, you're like, it's weird that he's not bisexual. Like, it's weird that him and Joshua Jackson aren't also like a devious other couple, you know? Yes.
Which I would pay money to see that, I mean, because those two are also
they kind
very
of have a
looking.
Flirty energy, but it's so, yeah, it's meager. Yeah.
Well, Roger Cumble actually addressed that. Cam, you sent me clips, or you sent me the whole thing of the unbelievable Cruel Intentions musical set to the hits of the day, including Genie in a Bottle and No Scrubs. Yeah. And don't worry, they do sing that Placebo song as aggressively as they can. but when they were doing, when he was kind of rewriting it for the stage, that stuff he actually took into consideration of like, is this too cringe for now? Especially the part where he seduces Selma Blair and starts blackmailing her. And that's, for me, that I think that was one of the more uncomfortable parts, because the power of that Selma Blair performance is she's so wide-eyed innocent. I mean, she's playing the Uma Thurman character, right? So it's that same kind of thing. And she's not a bright little bunny.
No, she's stupid. Like, I do give him that he tries to make her like a full doofus that you kind of have no sympathy for. But yeah, it's interesting. And it's interesting how... I don't think the musical is a bit hard to immediately watch, because it's very much the script of the movie. Like, there's almost no changes. But I do like that they lean into, like, the slurs are still in it, because it's almost like, isn't it ironic that we used to talk like this? Yeah, it's interesting. And I mean, I'm also fascinated with both of these movies. I kind of want to talk about that, like, you could have paid me $1 million and I never would have pulled the name Roger Cumble to say who wrote and directed Cruel Intentions. Like, both of these movies are kind of iconic without being like auteur driven, even though both are totally seem to be auteur driven, which is kind of wild to me. But yeah, I don't know. It's a strange film. It seems to have a lasting appeal though, Emil. Do you feel like, how does this movie connect across the years?
I mean, yes. Okay, if you look at like a show like Bridgerton, right? For like a kind of a current appeal of a similar genre, like a corset busting but uber horny romance story with some, you know, sexual intrigue. I think this is it's an iconic version of that super sexed up teen movie. I always remember the little cocaine.
Oh, cross.
Cross that Sarah Michelle Gellar's character has, like the reveal that she's like such a bad girl that she carries her drugs in a crucifix.
Yeah.
And I don't think that ever gets old, like the idea of playing with like, you know, good and bad and how they can both exist in one person. And I do really think it's like kind of Gossip Girl, but like a literary version, you know?
Yeah, it also has it has the weird thing. Some parts of it are totally not edgy anymore, but some parts of it now seem so edgy that it's like, will we ever get a teen movie as like purposefully in your face as this? Like, it seems like it was making daring choices the amount of drug use.
The kiss. Yeah.
The kiss. Oh, yeah. Let's get into this, because this this is my 1999. Like, remember 1999? Like. To describe, if there is anyone younger than us listening, like in 1998 was that Ally McBeal kiss. If you guys remember, that was like a huge deal. And that opened the floodgates for like lesbian kissing was like a ratings grab, and this was kind of a huge one. This is the first MTV same-sex kiss to win, even though, you know, stuff like Kevin Kline and What's-His-Face and In-N-Out were voted for MTV Movie Awards. But yeah, this one, was it, like, and it was a big deal, right? Like, I'm not crazy, like...
Enormous.
No, it was massive.
No, it was enormous.
I mean, I still think about it, because that is still a very provocative kiss. Mm,
yeah.
It was, like, slow motion. Sarah Michelle Gellar was just, like, acting, capital yeah. A. Yeah, we had just never seen anything like that. Our innocent little minds were blown.
So well, this movie was also R-rated, and they actually talk about how, I think this opened like 3 or 4 at the box office. Like, it wasn't huge, but they think one of the reasons for that is that kids couldn't get in to see this by themselves, and this is not a movie you'd want to sit with your parents. So tons of kids snuck into it. They bought tickets for other movies and snuck in. Had all of those kids paid for tickets, this would have been number one.
Interesting. Yeah, and I mean,
well, I saw it on VHS, obviously.
Yeah, of course. I'm a good boy, so I saw it much later. It's fascinating because, yeah, the thought of an R-rated teen movie is almost impossible these days. They would never theatrically. Like, I could see maybe Netflix. Netflix is really getting into that Cinemax zone, so mm-hmm. I can see them. And especially with, like, Euphoria and stuff, which is, like, a show that they're like, it's for adults. And you're like, bullshit. Yeah.
No, it's not.
Yeah, I kind of, I don't know. It's very, everything about this movie makes me, like, it makes me crazy because it's, like, trying to remember 1999 and where we were. But... yeah, it's. I'm also like fascinated because I'm super into the fact a movie that blew me away was Lethal Weapon. Has a long sequence. There's a lesbian in Lethal Weapon, and a large part of Lethal Weapon is Mel Gibson being disgusted by the thought of like being homophobic towards lesbians, including lesbian pornography. So the fact that there's that cultural shift in 10 years where we've decided, like, you know what, this is actually the heterosexual way to consume homosexuality is like two actresses you like kissing.
Yeah.
It's still, so weird.
Still very much in the like heterosexual gaze, right? It's like four men, straight men,
yeah,
to watch two of the biggest young actresses in the world make out. Similarly recreated with Neve Campbell and Denise Richards.
Another
iconic millennial lesbian.
That one
kiss.
Had penises in it, though. Also, we were all shocked by Kevin Bacon's wiener in Wild Things.
Yes,
accidental wiener. I didn't know,
but I will say at the same time, were you guys? I don't know if anyone looked it up. I was shocked to find out that Roger Cumble was a straight man, like that a straight man wrote and directed this film, because it does seem like it has a weird queer lean to it.
And it's the camp. I think it's the camp factor. And it's them going for this like gauzy European sort of look in a lot of things. There's a great quote by the cinematographer that I love where they say, it's shot very classic. Everything is beautiful, elegant, and tasteful. You won't find any TVs, kitchens, or other mundane things. The moment there was something mundane, we thought, let's find something else. So just like the beautiful pretension of no kitchens, too mundane. These people don't cook for themselves.
Boring.
Well, Ryan Philippe, too, was modeling for Prada at the time. So even though they had like a limited budget, like he's costumed by Prada because Prada was like, here, have a bunch of clothes if you're going to be, you know, displaying how handsome he looks in our outfits. Very Richard Gere in American Gigolo. Yeah.
I also think that like what you talk about with that redemption arc of him is odd. I think partially because he gets no comeuppance. But I think why it works is the recent Ryan of it. As much as it's worth saying he's a terrible bad man now. We don't like him anymore. But their chemistry is so real. And also knowing that she like rewrote her part, it's like that early Reese as producer. Something about them, they're so charming. And like that pool scene is so sexy. He has the best ass of any man on film almost. I don't even know.
You very much enjoyed this film, didn't you?
I like rewatching it every time. I feel like I've never learned about it. Is that a weird thing? Like, I feel like I always watch it and I'm like, all right. But this was the first time I like dug in, and it was a rich text. I don't know. What do you guys like it? I don't know.
I like it. And I think that like a big part of enjoying these films was like the specific star power attached to it, because again, this is like pre, you know, kind of 24/7 TMZ style nature of celebrity that we have now. They didn't have social media. They weren't sharing their lives in the same way. So when you learned about couples, or there was rumors about like off-screen romances, you kind of looked to the movie to like decipher clues as well. And I think that like having a cast this stacked around a movie that was so like overtly sexy was kind of impossible to top at that time. And I feel like it still holds up because we don't do sex in the same way. Like it's so sanitized now. And I think, you know, I've read a couple of pieces in the New Yorker about how that's even more the case. Like they've kind of taken, except for Netflix, as you mentioned, taking
it's
that
slowly
route,
getting there.
The erotic thrillers were kind of peaking at that time. And like now our sex is really sanitized. And I think that to have something so purposely and erotically charged for teens was like really groundbreaking. And that holds just because like we are almost like sort of neo-puritanical about sex in our movies again.
I have to say, for me, the only reason why I still find this, that I'm still able to watch it in this way, is that they're not teenagers. They're people very clearly in their 20s. Sure. And so I feel more comfortable watching them in this
fair
capacity.
Enough. That would be crazy. So like, that would be a totally different.
And I mean, exactly, it does help that like Selma Blair is clearly older than all of them by like a few years.
She's 5 years older than Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Yeah, I mean, it's also like interesting that you say, because it's like this teen boom in 98, 99 is also fascinating because pretty much none of these people are stars. Sarah Michelle Gellar is the closest. But then there's also this almost Brat Pack energy where like Sarah Michelle Gellar and Ryan Phillippe knew each other because they were both in soap operas in the early 90s. And like Ryan and Reese knew each other. And then you kind of hear that all these people also knew all the Jawbreaker people because they were bumming around L.A. And this was kind of like partially just like a let's put on a show because Roger Cumble knew all of them.
So the producer of this was also the producer of I Know What You Did Last Summer, which had Jennifer Love Hewitt and Sarah Michelle Gellar. And I think Ryan Phillippe's in that one as well. So I haven't seen that one in a long time. But yeah, so they were all in that movie. So there was actually a whole thing of whether or not they had Jennifer Love Hewitt in this film or not, and if there was a place for her. Because they were like, she's not really innocent enough to do the Selma Blair or the Reese Witherspoon, so what do we do? So their bone that they threw her was the 17 cover with her face on it.
I mean, I love it. Yeah, it's very fascinating because all these people suddenly, and like down to like Sean Patrick Thomas, who had a moment there too. It's just like alchemy, this 1999 teen movie thing to me, because we have a whole other episode, Emil, about Kirsten Dunst, and this is like a weird surprise. Kirsten Dunst is an amazing actress here too. But all these people, 10 Things I Hate About You is this year. It's like, it's bizarre.
They also weren't like huge stars, but like for that demographic and for what they were doing, movies like I Know What You Did Last Summer, it just was like such a specific genre unto itself, and they were such stars to us in that genre that you did kind of, it almost was like you anticipated the next movie where so and so would team up with so and so, and you were like, and who else are we going to see? And it did create this as you say, like a sense of a kind of a Brat Pack or this other like wave of celebrity, like this kind of yearbook, you know, freshman class of really exciting, attractive people that were not like your JTT, your Teen Beat stars. Like they were a little edgy. They were grown-ups, you know, like they probably did do drugs. Like there was something very exciting about them.
Well, one thing when you brought that up, it's also interesting that they are making enough of these movies that, for instance, people like Sarah Michelle Gellar's like, my agent's like, don't do this, you'll ruin your career. And she's like, I need to do this because I need to do something totally different. And I feel the same way. Like, it's interesting that it doesn't seem that Daring that Joshua Jackson plays a not even just a gay character, but like a pretty openly sexually lascivious gay character, because he's just in so much stuff. You know, like he's in The Skulls, he's in Urban Legend, he's in Apt People. Like he's fine. He can throw off a gay role because he's in so many movies.
Oh my god, The Skulls. What? There were so many of these movies.
Yes.
It's wild.
And I think it's a thing that, like, I think that this is a rich vein for Gen Z too. Like, I think that they should get into, they don't realize what they're missing with like disturbing behavior and these weird movies that you could be enjoying that are just like weird R-rated teen movies.
The other thing I think they're missing too that I'm waiting for more of a revival of is the soundtrack. The soundtrack of this is really good. And I mean, maybe this is just like my nostalgia, but I'm like, no, this is like everything fits really nicely, even though it's all pop hits of the day. Nothing feels like it's tacked in because the studio said it had to be in there because they own the record label. Like, it's really something special. Did you guys kind of find the same thing where you're like, oh, I love this song?
Oh yeah, this is soundtrack heyday. Like Jawbreaker as well. These are like these are CDs, yes, that you went and specifically bought because they were so expertly curated. Like, it was the directors making you a personal playlist, and it felt, again, like access to a subculture that you might not otherwise have access to, because you wouldn't have the money to buy like 10 different CDs and discover the band. And usually it was a great way to break smaller bands, like sort of younger indie bands, which, you know, of course now we're like, they were huge hits, but these were often, especially in Jawbreaker, like these were like genuinely cool bands that you might not otherwise discover if you didn't have like an older sibling. And so I think like the soundtrack is unto itself a lost art, because like, you know, now it's just really easy. You can keep adding to a show's Spotify playlist. It doesn't feel special, but like you had to go and pay money for that thing. And so I love a movie soundtrack when it's done well and introduces like young people to new bands or new sounds. Like, it kind of is like the, like an extension of the director's craft, not to sound like a total wanker.
But... No, totally. Yeah. I also think that it's you see the breakdown of the like big studio system in the loss of that soundtrack, partially because like Warner Brothers or Sony or MGM or whatever usually had a record label that was significant and they had enough artists that they could cram these with pop songs. And now if you get a teen movie, it's usually like one repeated theme, you know. It's like, oh hey, that song is back, because they can only afford like two or three, unless they like make a deal to essentially say, you know, Harry Styles did all the songs of this, or like, I guess it's always Billie Eilish and Phineas these days, but it's like, yeah, all the songs are by them, they're good. But it's like, oh yeah, there used to be such a variety because they could go through their entire stable of artists, and like you say, they'd be waiting to break an artist.
Yeah,
they would be like, yeah, hey, here's this.
Oh my god, the Romeo and Juliet soundtrack is like, what?
I was literally just thinking, I mean, top five.
They have it's kind of wild that Love Fool is also in this movie, like in a pretty equal way, where it's like, it's almost referencing that he put on the Romeo and Juliet soundtrack to seduce a girl, which is
as you would in 1999,
yeah. Amen, yeah.
Well, because I was thinking about Bittersweet Symphony, because I mean, that song and the ending is so good and it matches up so perfectly. And that's because, here is a filmmaking tip for you kids, never do this. They matched up the whole thing and the edit to that song, thinking they'd be able to get the song. And of course, it ended up being $1 million. So they tried on like literally $1 million for this one song. That's a large portion of their budget.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
I think they said it was 20% of their budget or something.
It's just for the use of the one song.
Symphony. But it's so good.
Totally. It's so good. It really does make the movie, and it's so much so iconic. And so I went down a bit of a rabbit hole on this. I just want to get into this because Bittersweet Symphony, of course, is notoriously controversial because it samples part of the Rolling Stones' The Last Time, an instrumental version of it. And Alan Klein, who we've talked about being a maniac on the podcast previously, is the manager of the Rolling Stones as well as being the manager of the Beatles. And he allowed the Verve, the band, to use five notes from the song. They could use that in their sample. They instead used seven notes. And as a direct result, instead of the 50% profit share that was agreed upon, they ended up losing all of the shares. The Grammy nominations went to Keith Richards and Mick Jagger. The Verve was not connected with it. They lost millions and millions of dollars because they used two extra notes. Now, Alan Klein died recently, and his son is much more level-minded, and this has now been reversed. So now the Verve is getting, I believe, almost 100% of their profits. From here on in, they will be making everything from Bittersweet Symphony. So kids, they've got some making up to do. Please go use Bittersweet Symphony in your stuff.
Watch Cruel Intentions.
Yeah. Totally. But I was just like, man, what a nightmare.
Is that why they just like fell off after that huge song, and you just never heard from them again?
100%.
I bet you they would have been bigger if they had that money.
For sure. And also, like, don't be greedy, though. You know, you got five notes. Use the five notes judiciously.
Touche. Say what you mean. One thing I wanted to talk about just briefly, because again, fascinating, and a thing I was obsessed with, because I don't know about you guys, but I was a big Entertainment Tonight watcher back in 1999/2000. So do you remember, I'm obsessed with the multiple attempts to like capitalize, like Cruel Intentions is technically a franchise, but in the messiest way ever.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Because so great. The first thing was they tried to make a spin-off prequel TV show called Manchester Prep, which starred Amy Adams in the Sarah Michelle Gellar role, which is wild enough. But if the entertainment tonight of it all is they premiered a trailer for this show that, and part of it involves a Catherine essentially, you know, it's doing the Selma Blair stuff where she's like harassing a girl, but she harasses a girl on a horse to make her like reposition herself on the saddle until she orgasms. And that trailer was so controversial that apparently Rupert Murdoch saw it and the entire series was scrapped on Fox, which on 1999 Fox is hard to believe something was like too hot for Fox. So that stuff, the first three episodes of that show are cobbled together into a really terrible Cruel Intentions 2. There's also a Cruel Intentions 3 that is completely, it's one of those ones where it's like, this is the Martell's like cousin Joey. Like, it has nothing to do with anything. But then again, there was a great sounding NBC pilot recently, which was implied that Reese Witherspoon's character was pregnant at the end of the film. And this is her son grown up who finds his father, Ryan Phillippe's diary, and that which leads him to Catherine, played once again by Sarah Michelle Gellar, as an adult. And it's like conniving business drama, which sounds good, but apparently shot a pilot and didn't get picked up. But now again, apparently there's some sort of TV show coming, which is... It seems like just a borderline cursed property, partially because I think Roger Cumble tends to be involved and tends to say, this is about, you know, erotic games, guys. You need to get into it.
Oh, the sexual mind games of teenagers.
Yeah, though also now it's like of a 45-year-old woman, I guess. I don't know. It's
kind of weird.
You know what I think the problem is? I think they can't get Christine Baranski back because she's busy, and that's what really is tanking it every single time.
I would be shocked. I wrote down literally before I watched either of these movies, I was like, we should probably talk about how white these movies are. And then I'm like, oh, there's actually like a fascinating racial undertone in Cruel Intentions that at least is like the upper class is racist. And they kind of don't do anything with it, but I was surprised. I had totally blanked on that plot.
All right. Well, I think that's the perfect moment for us to head into our next film. Weirdly, the darker of the two. When we come back, we're going to be looking at Jawbreaker. And that's coming up after the break. The sweetest candies are sour as death inside. With a tagline like that, who wouldn't want to crack open Jawbreaker and see the inner workings? Featuring some of my personal favorite actors like Carol Kane, Pam Grier, and Judy Greer, and cameos by deep-cut film folk like PJ Souls. Where Cruel Intentions is sleek, polished, and sexy, Jawbreaker is shaggy, candy-colored, and sleazy, and is just as enduring and influential as Cruel Intentions will ever be. There's something for everyone. All right, let's get into it. Emil, Jawbreaker, what's this one about?
Okay, so Jawbreaker is about a group of extremely popular girls in high school. They kidnap their friend. It's an annual birthday tradition. The, you know, eponymous Jawbreaker is kind of a tool used to gag the most popular of the group. As they are driving to have a milkshake with her, they pop open the trunk and boom, she's dead. And then the ensuing film is about the cover-up. It is about what lengths we'll go to fit in and be popular. It's about the ravaging cost of the social hierarchy in high school. And it's about incredible, as you mentioned, candy-colored, pastel-hued outfits that were just, if Clueless was an acid trip, that... Those are the outfits of Jawbreaker.
Well, I love that you bring that up because on previous episodes, we've talked about Mona May, who was integral to the 90s costume scene. She did Clueless. She did Romy Michelle's High School Reunion. The costume designer here is Vicki Barrett, who was her protege. So you're seeing a lot of that candy-colored fashion and like the very avant-garde 90s fashion reflected here because of that.
Well, she nailed it. She nailed it.
She did. Yeah. I actually like these costumes. I'm not going to say more, but I think they should be in the same pantheon for, like, they're sexy and provocative, but also have clear definitions of why each character is wearing which. Like, it's a proper design of costume, not just cool clothing all around.
Sure.
And the music, as I mentioned, like, this is a great, great soundtrack. And this is just a cooler film. Like, Cruel Intentions is obviously teen canon, but Jawbreaker was for if you were slightly the cooler person in your group and you wanted to, like, introduce something into, like, the sleepover that was going to be daring and interesting and actually, like, a film as opposed to just, like, whatever you could get at Blockbuster in front of your parents. Like, you kind of had to know where to find this movie.
Well, this was a movie that was made by the home video division of Sony. It wasn't intended for theatrical release, but when they had kind of Can't Hardly Wait and about all these teen movies, like we mentioned earlier, were like coming out rapid fire, they're like, okay, well, what else do we have that we can give a theatrical release to? So this kind of ended up kind of bumped up. However, that being said, they had to choose between releasing Can't Hardly Wait and this and kind of betting on which horse they thought was going to do better. So they put all their marketing money behind Can't Hardly Wait. And then financially, they actually lost out because Can't Hardly Wait cost $10 million to make and it only really doubled its budget. And, like, we don't really talk about that movie anymore.
Well, Jawbreaker cost.
Yeah, I was going to say, I do. I was there opening totally day, Becky.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen that movie like 100 times.
Sure.
But go on.
We all love a Jenna Elfman cameo. Come on.
I love it. Well, Jawbreaker has made exponentially more money. And, you know, there was the musical version, etc. Like, it just has much more pop culture cachet. Like you said, Emil, it's the cool kid movie as opposed to Can't Hardly Wait, right? Yeah. Like, it's more the thing that you're going to kind of pass to people under
this
the wire.
This is also, it's worth saying, I was a little surprised to never read that there had to be stuff cut out of Cruel Intentions. I think it was made very carefully and studio-y, whereas this one was an NC-17 film that they had to, like, slowly slice down to R-rated, which, again, I think proves the weirdness of, like, the 1999 and what is considered NC-17 is like a guy deep throating a lollipop and stuff like that.
The other thing is this movie wouldn't have been released a few months later because Columbine happened in April and this was released in February. So it's just those few months, this movie wouldn't have seen the light of day, no question.
Yeah, they didn't like killing kids for a couple of years there.
I think in the same way that you know, 9/11 colors a generation's experience into adulthood, like, you can't really underscore how much Columbine shifted our experience of adolescence and how parents talked about us and treated us and how our kind of school experience went based on that incident. Like, I forgot about it, but when you say that, I just go back to, like, how dramatic of a shift in our lives that moment was.
Oh yeah, and I think we talk a lot in film, it's kind of a fascinating moment for a lot of adult films and what, like, kind of a starting of shielding adult content. And a lot of these R-rated, especially the horror side teen movies, just drop off entirely. And the big, the one I always point to is the difference between Scream 2 and Scream 3 is essentially Columbine. They needed to make it a little funnier and lighter and we're all having a good time and nobody's seeing any blood. And and I think that you definitely see that here too. Like, it is weird that there's nothing happening in Jawbreaker is Columbine.
No.
It's not even a film that's necessarily that heavy on bullying. It's mostly kind of light barbed comments. You don't see a lot of, like, beating people up or as bad as we know bullying is.
Yeah.
I also think it's one of the strongest movies I've seen about a budding sociopath, about someone who is figuring out what the boundaries are and what she's able to get away with based on money and looks and the fact that she realizes she has this power. And it's a really interesting character study for that Courtney character played by Rose McGowan.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Fern Mayo. Because she's also a budding sociopath, right?
And she arguably gets away with it too.
Yes.
Like, yeah. She
can we all agree though that Fern Mayo is the greatest name for any sort of bland character in any film? It's
if
so
I
good.
Don't think about Fern Mayo at least once a month, I mean, color me dead. But but to explain, like, so Fern Mayo is the kind of the outsider, the geek, the overlooked, quiet, mousy girl who observes this popular group from a distance, and then she kind of accidentally sees them trying to, you know, plant this, cover up this murder. And this is her in to the popular crowd. She keeps quiet and they transform her from Fern Mayo to Violet.
Don't fool yourself. Deep down, they know who you are. Fern. I'm Violet.
And the way that power goes to her head and the way she suddenly becomes drunk on that social currency and on who she can be as Violet, as opposed to who she had to be as Fern Mayo, is so fascinating and so interesting. And I think what is so great about this film is, even though it involves dead bodies and it involves this kind of like, yeah, undercurrent of like psychological or horror, it's really just a movie about fitting in, and especially the drama that that plays out between young women and how we kind of isolate each other and also attack each other and the cynicism within those girl groups. And the Fern Mayo character is a stand-in for all of that, and it's so amazing. And Judy Greer is just like incredible.
Yeah.
May I point the listeners to exactly what t-shirt Cameron Maitland chose to wear
today? Judy Greer should be the lead, which she is in this one. They get it. She's correct. One of the leads. yes, my shirt that now I'm too embarrassed to wear anywhere but work. It's a fascinating movie. And I think you're right. It's interesting that the focus is not, it's not necessarily like noir-ish. It's not really about this crime. It's mm-hmm. much more just about the machinations of high school. And I think that that's partially one thing I kind of want to connect to this is it's sort of the end of the new queer cinema, which is people like Gus Van Sant, Todd Haynes, Cheryl Dunier. Like, so I think it's very much in the tradition of Greg Araki, who broke Rose McGowan. So she was in Doom Generation, and then obviously she's in Scream. She's in Charmed by this point. But she really talks about, it's interesting reading her talk about this movie, that she was very much into doing like another queer, ironic, kind of like heightened, weird movie that she thought would like freak out the straights. That's like why she was attracted to this. And also to know that he originally wrote this for Parker Posey, who essentially was like, I can't do high school anymore. She was like, I am too old officially. No more high school for Parker. But yeah, I think that there is that kind of John Watersy feel, but the darkness definitely of Greg Araki and that like, LA is a nightmare teenager wasteland where people are just going feral, and that's part of the business. Like, none of the adults particularly seem phased, which I also think comes from Daniel Waters and Heather's. Like, I do think that there is that influence of like adults are just like except for Pam Grier, who's kind of invested.
Yeah.
I mean, I always come back to River's Edge with that. One of the reasons River's Edge works the way it does is because the parents are so checked out and so not involved. And that's, I think, really, it's a component that makes a good horror, right? It's like, this is why the kids are running rampant and why they're acting out, because the parents aren't okay. That's why.
True.
Yeah.
I do want to get into Rose McGowan just for a second, because I think she's really good in this. And she was also at a really interesting place pop culturally as well. Like, now, unfortunately, after the Weinstein thing, like, there's a whole other thing that we talk about her for. But like, where was she kind of at in 99?
She was the interesting, the kind of opposite side of the teen starlet coin, right? She was the one, the goth girl, the alterna girl. She was, known for her provocations on red carpets, that incredible chain dress with her whole bum hanging out, which was just like burned into my memory. She was like, in the same way that Jawbreaker is like the cool kids teen movie, Rose McGowan was the cool kids teen star. She was like someone that you could aspire towards. Her dialogue was always like really snappy and edgy. She always seemed to know a little bit more than everyone else in the room in her roles. She's like that teen that is precocious without wanting to hang with the grown-ups, like she obviously knows as much as the adults do, but she uses it to manipulate and control her peers as opposed to moving upwards. She controls downwards. And I think there was something like you know, not to sound kind of cliche, but like rock and roll and mm-hmm. and just exciting about her. And you knew her choices were, they've always felt very deliberate. Like she never felt like someone like a Sarah Michelle Gellar or Jennifer Love Hewitt, who, you know, a lot of their roles felt forced upon them by an agent or like a very monetary decision. And it always felt like Rose McGowan was very deliberate about her roles because they were part of this body of work that was like part of a kind of an outsider oeuvre of film. Mm.
Yeah, she also is like a bit more of a character actor. Like you can't really make her the regular, you know, yeah. every woman. She would never fit into that just because I don't know if it's baggage or I think she's capable of acting like that, but it's like you would never cast her as that. So it's interesting because she was so popular, but this is a rare lead role for her, you know, like mm-hmm. it's not something she usually got outside of indies and weird movies. I also wanted to go back to like another kind of like explain to different generations thing that you were talking about, Emil, like without the internet, she's also a part of this, like, which this movie is too, this like retro kitsch wave, mm-hmm. which it's hard to describe that, but like that was cool because it was inaccessible at the time.
Yeah.
Like if you wanted to dress retro, you had to get like either handmade clothes or like the actual vintage stuff before vintage was cool. And like all that tiki bar, like Dita Von Teese LA stuff was cool. And she was kind of like the queen of it.
Exactly. And it's interesting, like we're talking a lot about Rose McGowan and Judy Greer, but probably one of the most recognizable faces in the film is Rebecca Gayhart, who is the Noxzema girl. Even if you didn't know her name, she was on your commercials every night. She was the face of Noxzema, which no one uses anymore because it's basically like menthol.
I do remember that smell walking to my aunt's place.
Me.
Yep.
I was like, I could be a Noxzema girl. But Rebecca Gayhart was like the epitome of the girl next door. She's the, you know, she has that face that you want. She's selling this product because she is so relatable. And to see Rose McGowan and just eclipse her completely in this film, like you kind of forget Rebecca Gayhart's there and she's so one dimensional. And I personally don't consider her to be even in the kind of mediocre to great realm of actresses, but it's interesting how much over time she's just completely forgotten about as far as like the conversation around Jawbreaker.
Yeah, it's interesting too because she kind of had her Sarah Michelle Gellar moment the year before in Urban Legend where she is, but it's like a twist because again, yeah, she's the Noxzema girl, she's the good girl, so spoiler alert, twist, she's the bad girl. But then they even unfortunately have a reveal in Urban Legend 2, which did not do well, that she's like still around and there's going to be like a league of bad urban legends at the end of it. But she's an interesting woman, and of course it's interesting because I think she's now kind of forgiven for it, but her career was totally derailed because she ran over a child. I think she's been quite open about how that, like, as it would, destroyed her life personally because she killed a child. I think she's kind of back, and it's interesting to see her just as a person who's, you know, the public is willing to talk about and to again. But yeah, this was kind of her era. I totally forgot she was a Noxzema girl, though. Now it's burnt in my mind.
Oh, I only think about her as a Noxzema girl or as the person who killed that child.
Yes, boy.
Yeah,
but also married to Eric Dane, who is Mick Steamy from Grey's Anatomy. So.
And they've been married forever, kind of, too, haven't they? Yeah. Yeah, like before he was famous, maybe even. Yeah, and she now just seems to be a mom trying to get by.
Oh, my God. Like I was just going to say, she's in every, like, kind of like Gwyneth Paltrow style Instagram or Kate Hudson is a great example. Instagram celebrity. If you check, there's always a double tap from Rebecca Gayhart or she's in the comments like, oh, heart, heart, heart. So that's her. That's kind of her playing field these days.
Yeah. And I will say that there was a weird you could see that, oh gosh, I can't even remember his name. American Horror Story guy. What's that guy's name?
Ryan Murphy.
He loves Jawbreaker, obviously, because both Rose McGowan and obviously. Rebecca Gayhart appeared on Nip Tuck as like different doctors. That show, which also Gen Z should dig up because it was insane and a clearinghouse of these people.
Ryan Murphy also has a whole, like him and the comparison between Darren Stein is so obvious for me because Darren Stein is here bringing back all of his favorites, right? Like you have almost the entire cast of Carrie brought back here with the exception of like John Travolta and Sissy Spacek. You got PJ Souls, you got William Catt, you know, he's filling all these roles. I mean, Pam Grier is in this movie and God, I love when she shows up, but he's doing the same thing that Ryan Murphy does is he brings back these actors that he's always loved watching and gives them these roles. I mean, Carol Kane is in this in like a super tiny role. You know, I was waiting. I mean, Swoozy Kurtz is in the other movie. So obviously she was busy and couldn't do this one. But it's so interesting to me, like that this would kind of continue to be a pattern of these young people and these filmmakers being like, I love these older actresses specifically. Let's bring them in and give them work. Help them out with their side.
I also think it's knowing that they'll get it right. Like you know that all of these people get what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And will bring you some level of something. It's also to be said that like a movie could be sold on that. You could be like, you know, Pam Grier's in this. She was just in Jackie Brown. Whereas nowadays you need like an Oscar winner to sell any single thing. It's just not. Yeah, I don't know. It's very fascinating. And I will say I was just like, how's Rebecca Gayhart doing? And I did notice that she is in. She's said to be in a reboot of Urban Legend. So one of her iconic roles is back, baby.
There we go. Everything is new is old.
Yes.
I love LA ephemera and stories, speaking of urban legends and things. And this gave me the treat of going down the Angeline billboard thing. Are you guys familiar with Angeline?
Sure, yeah. Okay.
I didn't know about
TV series,
this.
Becky.
That's what I saw. It was played by Emmy Rossum. So watching the scene where the Violette character is now like on her hot pink Cadillac in like the full bitch pink like PVC skin tight uniform, she's doing Angelique billboards, and it looks cool. So you don't even know, or Angelique billboards. It looks cool. You don't actually need to know who Angelique is, but anyone from LA would know exactly what she's doing. Emil, do you want to fill us in who Angelique was?
Angelique was like this kind of classic Hollywood character of this woman who'd had all these surgeries to basically look like Barbie. And she had taken out these billboards in across Los Angeles, just selling herself, really. Like, I don't, not literally, but creating a, building a mystique around Angelique. And if it was kind of ever present in the backdrop of California, if you were driving around LA, you would see an Angelique billboard. And she just, I think it's almost like few decades too short, because if she was doing that now, she would be a worldwide phenomenon and everyone would know her because of the internet. But it, like, it was a very specific LA thing, but me in Vancouver as a, you know, greedy little pop culture consumer knew of her just because it was such a part of this specific lore of that era of celebrity. Or this is pre-reality stars, right? So she was like kind of the prototypical of reality star, because she didn't, she was just famous for being famous, and she was famous because she took out all these billboards of herself.
There's actually a discussion that Paris Hilton took a lot of the look and the voice and everything from that specific character, seeing how well it worked for her to get attention. Yeah.
And there's good, if you go through Hollywood history, there's good people. I can't remember what starlet. Somebody walked down the street with an ocelot all the time. She had like a giant jungle cat. You know, people would throw stuff out of planes. And it's worth saying Angelique also had the pink Corvette that she would drive around, and she would also give you a headshot signed if you just approached her on the street, which is smart.
She sold her own merch out of her trunk, which I love. She had her own magazine that she printed, and you could buy it for $50 an issue. I mean, that's entrepreneurship.
And I mean,
all these
people have kind of migrated to the internet, but it used to be like, I mean, we live in Toronto, and there was plenty of Toronto people like Angelique that now have kind of disappeared too.
Gotta bring that type of star back, you know.
Yeah, okay, well, I'll go and do something.
Let's get a billboard.
Why not? Just a mysterious one. This is a thing, though, YouTubers do. Like, L.A. has a billboard culture that we don't really have in Canada. I mean, the States in general, billboards. But, like, L.A. billboards are much more a thing. And YouTubers actually use them on a regular basis in L.A. Like, you're not something unless you have a billboard. And I remember seeing one on The Gardener here in Toronto for a YouTuber. And I was like, do people do that? Like, do children watch things based on what they see on billboards? But apparently it's a prestige thing to be a YouTuber and have your own billboard.
All it is money, baby. Anyone can get a billboard. but I want to encourage people. One thing I just wanted to ask about to you, both of you, I'm very interested that this film, they also speak in like a very weird language that is like almost clueless, almost not. It's like just kind of an unusual way. And it seems like it was a big 90s thing of like essentially making up teen vernacular.
I killed Liz. I killed the teen dream. Deal with it.
And I don't have any point, really, but I'm just like, what up with that? Do we like that? Should that come back? Just like adults faking teen language.
I think if you think about like the ways in which adults had to like specifically seek out access to cool children was like not the way it is now, where you can just like be on TikTok for an hour and now you speak an entirely different language. You know, you really had to know. You had to have ins. And so I think, but I think the slang, the idea of us speaking in a totally different way from our adults and our seniors was like this obsession. I mean, as it always is with older generations, but I think at that time, like our kind of like our boomer parents really had no idea what we were saying. And there was this obsession with how we spoke and what we were saying and what we were talking about. And that like, it was kind of pre just the advent of like text shorthand. So like it, you know, it did roll into that. So I think like the obsession with teen speak really seemed to peak in that like late 90s, early 2000s. Don't you like this?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I agree.
Yeah. And every movie kind of had, you can find a lot of it. And then they're almost making fun of it in Mean Girls with Fetch, where it's like, no, that doesn't exist. Like the Mean Girls don't speak. They speak in regular language. Yeah.
But bringing up Mean Girls is an interesting thing, though, because that's the sanitization we're talking about, because Heather's is incredibly dark. This, like, the dead body in the trunk with, like, the blue, the eyes all grayed out and the actual jawbreaker lodged in her throat and, like, the is pretty grotesque, and the movie's pretty grotesque. And then Mean Girls, like, the most shocking moment of it is when Regina George gets hit by the car, but she's fine. And the Mean Girls aren't even that mean in that movie. So, like, you can kind of draw the through line of that, but also see it is a declining arch of actual meaning.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that I don't, in a weird defense of Mean Girls, it's based on a sociological text about how girls are mean to each other in school. So I think it's more like she applied a Heather's lens to it. But yeah, this movie, I think I forgot that this movie is a bit crueler than Heather's because it really goes there with like rape stuff, which is a bit kind of wild. But I don't know. The teen speak's fascinating because I guess, I mean, Euphoria kind of has a teen language of its own, but it also is so obsessed with like therapy language and adult stuff that it kind of, I don't know.
I also think it maybe depends on how close the person is to it. Like Darren Stein is 25 when he did this, you know, and obviously he's hanging out with other young people throughout LA, and LA of course had like its own language unto itself that you're also getting from movies like Clueless, right? Like that sort of young Southern Californian language, right? And that then kind of permeated the rest of North American culture.
And I guess there's a timelessness to it. I don't if you make up a language, I don't know.
I don't know. I love modern slang. My small person is 8 and we were going to get coffee and donuts. And as we're walking along, he's like, we be coppin'. And I was like, I'm sorry, we're what? And he's like, we be coppin' and coffee and donuts. I was like, oh, we be coppin'. Cop police officer.
No, I thought you meant you were copping the donuts, getting them.
No, we are copping as in we are going to go do something that police officers do, which I thought was very funny and very weird.
You've got to educate him about the carceral state, Becky. Get him out of that.
I know.
Too much propaganda.
I love it. All right, on that note, I'm ending this episode. So Cameron Maitland, thank you once again for conceiving this episode and also suggesting our fantastic guest today.
Oh, yes. Thank you. And I will say that look up behind-the-scenes photos of Jawbreaker with Darren Stein because he's a great late 90s twink just loving life on the set of Jawbreaker.
So many odd shaped sunglasses. Yes, so many wonderful odd shaped sunglasses
and haircuts. Yeah.
Neil, thank you so much for joining us for the first time. Hopefully not the last.
Thanks for having me. This was so much fun. I cannot wait to look up those pictures of Darren Stein.
I believe there's a Vice oral history that I think has a lot of great ones.
That sounds correct.
Can you please tell people how they can hear more of your work and follow you?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at Emil, A-M-I-L, and you can listen to Pop Chat every Wednesday wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And you can join us in 2 weeks where we're going to have a blast from the past. Literally a blast from the past. Because we're looking at that movie as well as The Mummy, and that's coming up in 2 weeks. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies and the series that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. On 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. Today's episode featured Cameron Maitland and Emil Niazi as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagne. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.